Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In December, the state of Iowa will turn 175 years old. To mark this milestone, the history journal Annals of Iowa has put together an issue filled with thought-provoking essays that explore many different topics in Iowa history, and those essays are in conversation with the original artwork of 16 Iowa artists. This hour, I'll talk with Ashley Howard, Assistant Professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Iowa. She wrote an essay titled Race and Iowa History, and multidisciplinary artist Akwi Inji will be here. Her piece for this project is called Uprising Does Not Always Roar Like a Fire. But first, Andrew Klump is on the line. He is a historian and the editor of Annals of Iowa. Hello, Andrew.
Hey, good morning, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I know you spent a lot of time thinking about what you wanted to do to mark the 175th anniversary of statehood here in Iowa. Give me an overview. What is the idea behind this edition?
Yeah, so this was a really exciting and fun project for a historian like me because it came about so organically. One of the state archivists here at the State Historical Society said, well, what about a special issue? And I said, well, I think we could do that. And it very quickly snowballed from there, bringing in new historians and old friends, but also bringing in artists to kind of mark this moment. And one of the things we wanted to do with this issue was really not just celebrate that Iowa turned 175, which is wonderful, but also to kind of put a mile marker in this moment, to have folks write, where are we? What are we doing in Iowa history right now? I tell folks that about for Iowa's 150th, Dorothy Schweder, a very well-known Iowa historian, wrote her kind of still classic book, Iowa, the Middle Land. And this doesn't pretend to take its place, but it's very much inspired by that, taking a moment to put down a mile marker to look at where we've been, what we're doing now, and what we hope to do in the future.
Well, and we are not just marking the 175th anniversary of the state. We're also living in this moment where the study and teaching of history is at the center of a political battle. And I'm sure that was going through your mind as well.
Yeah, I think that it's always great when we can introduce new audiences to history and to offer new perspectives on it. And so what this really has done is given us an opportunity to think about why it's important and why we need to keep studying history and how people like the artists who have contributed so richly to what we're doing also have a voice in what it is to think about and live in Iowa. One of our feature essays was by Pamela Riney Kerberg, who's at Iowa State, and she writes all about the importance of state and local history, which is so true in this moment, that it's important that we know where we're from and why Iowa and Iowa history matters.
Well, it feels like we also are at this moment of reckoning, and this has been going on for a long time, but it seems to have come to a head just recently, where, you know, I was born in 1975, and I grew up in a time where history in the United States, in my schools, U.S. history, Iowa history, it was really taught in a celebratory American exceptionalism way. And it took me a lot of years to fill in the gaps. There were so many things I was not taught. And now we're at this moment where we're trying to say, okay, we can study history, we can understand history in its fullness. And that doesn't mean that we are denigrating the history of this country, but we need to understand what's actually come before. We can't just celebrate and enforce this mythology.
Right. You know, and I think, you know, we do that in this journal, and we do it in the journal every quarter. We publish every quarter, but in this one particular, you know, we grapple with the challenges, the struggles, the failures, and the successes, right? And I think about, you know, even our family stories, right? The way we tell our family history. My family's been in Iowa since the 1860s, up in Cherokee County, and you know, there are stories of struggle. You know, there are stories of loss. There are stories of pain that come through our family stories and stories of celebration. So I think that, you know, if that's part of how people tell history, it has to have those struggles and the failures and the challenges and also the celebrations. It all works together to tell that really rich story. And we try to do that here. We try to include it all so that the moments we celebrate are worth celebrating more, and the struggles can teach us lessons. You know, it's the full story. We do our best, and we still know there's so much more to study. But I think we try to tell and explore history in that very real way that takes into account everything that's possible and is true to how we tell our own stories, you know, in our families. We don't just tell the good parts. We also remember the hard times, which make those good times all the sweeter.
Tell me about the idea of bringing artists into this conversation, because you have included some incredible original artwork that looks at Iowa from so many different perspectives in this publication. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah, you know, that's another one that just came about very organically. We're housed, the State Historical Society is a part of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, which means that every day I am working with and alongside of my colleagues in the Iowa Arts Council and Produce Iowa, which is our film society here. Our film office, excuse me. And so I think it came about very naturally in conversations with my colleagues in the Arts Council that what would it look like to do a special cover? Well, could we have inserts? And we had these themed essays, and my colleagues were saying that, you know, Iowa artists are thinking about these same things as well. And so it just came about very organically. And what I love about it is in the journal, our historians are our historians. They write really serious and careful academic history. And our artists are artists. They do their visual art. They engage in the ways that are authentic to them. It's both authentic and organic at the same time, that partnership. And I really have loved that. So it was really a question of why not? You know, here's this opportunity. Why not take advantage of it to really mark this moment as special?
How did you choose the artists that would be included?
Yeah, we were just delighted. We put out a call for art with my colleagues in the Arts Council actually ran this part, but they put out a call for art, and we received an overwhelming response from Iowa artists with incredible submissions. And so what we did was we carefully looked at all of these submissions, and we kept in mind the themes that were organizing the issue. So we had Iowa and the importance of state and local history, or race in Iowa history, like Ashley and Akwi, who you'll talk to later, but also themes like pre-statehood, what was Iowa like beforehand. And so we looked at each of these categories, choosing a piece or two, or in some cases three, that really fit well with the theme that we were discussing. And so it was kind of a process of looking at really an abundance and trying to decide what the best contributions were for this moment. I wish we could have featured them all because it was all so outstanding. And we've got so many talented Iowa artists here in the state.
So the artwork isn't necessarily responding precisely to what the historians are writing about, but
right,
in a more general sense.
Right. So what's happened, and I think is really dynamic and magical about it, right, is I talked to our historians and said, I want you to write an essay that looks at where we've been, where we're going, and you know, on this particular theme, so agriculture, for example. And then our Arts Council colleagues were able to say to artists, we want to look at how you have grappled with agriculture in art, right? And so the theme was shared. All the artists and the historians were given the same theme, and then they were able to engage with it on their own terms, right? So we have reflections on and thoughtful engagement with the same ideas, but from very distinct perspectives. So they're very much in conversation with each other, even if they aren't, you know, they didn't read one another's work and then try to base it off of that.
Now, over the next couple of months, I'm going to be talking with some of the historians, some of the essays mm-hmm. featured in this edition of Annals of Iowa. So we'll take a little bit deeper dive into some of the other topics also included in the journal. What are some of the highlights from your perspective? I know you're very excited about all of it, but be honest, what are some of the highlights for you?
I love the way that so many themes appeared throughout the essays, right? So I, as the editor, got to see it all come together. And one of the things that was so exciting for me was to see how themes of Iowa as a diverse place, a place that isn't just flyover country, came out of almost every essay. says there's more to the story. There's more that's going on here. Iowa has tremendous religious diversity, tremendous geographic diversity as far as where people are from, tremendous social economic diversity. It has increasing racial diversity, increasing ethnic diversity, right? There was this theme of there's more to Iowa than meets the eye. Iowa is more than flyover country. And I've always believed that. I'm from Iowa. I did my schooling in the South, and I was kind of an Iowa booster when I was there, and I was glad to come home. But I think that's the theme that comes out for me, is that regardless of the particular topic that an historian or an artist was engaging with, we kept coming back to the idea that there's more than meets the eye. Iowa is far more vibrant and far more engaging than people, especially those outside the state, give us credit for.
One of the things that has changed over the years, we are teaching a fuller history of our country and our state. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When we're teaching it, there's not as much of an emphasis on Iowa mm-hmm. history in our schools these days. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, right? I went to school up at Hartley Melvin Sanborn Consolidated Schools up in O'Brien County, and I remember in sixth grade having the blue Iowa history book that was written by Dorothy Schweder and Tom Moraine. And so that was what my experience of Iowa history was like. And I think there's so much more that can be done, and we're trying to offer those opportunities. We've got wonderful primary source sets that are put out by the Department of Cultural Affairs, National History Day, some really robust programming. And actually, one of our essays here in this issue actually talks about Iowa, the teaching of Iowa history and what that has looked like, and looks at the ways that in some ways it's actually increased or changed. Most schools are integrating Iowa history throughout their curriculum rather than, in my, you know, when I was young, having a semester of Iowa history in sixth grade or something like that. So it's hard for me to say exactly, not being a teacher myself, but I see positive signs, and I know the work that my colleagues, especially in our education department, are doing to try to give those resources to teachers. So I hope that we can be real partners in expanding Iowa history education, because I think it's important. It's important people know where they're from and know how places have been shaped and will continue to shape them.
And for people who want to dig deeper into this edition, where can they find the Annals of Iowa, Andrew?
Yeah, so the best way to find it is to go to our website, iowaculture.gov, and there'll be banners on the front page, but you can also click into the publications page, and that will allow you to buy this particular issue if you want it, or you could subscribe if you want to receive them going into the future. We also have our back catalog that's available if you look in and say, oh, I'd like to know more about something. So that's all online at our website. And you can find more about
Andrew,
that there.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. Andrew Klump, editor of Annals of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, conversations inspired by the 175th anniversary of Iowa statehood, a milestone that is approaching in December. To mark this occasion, the history journal Annals of Iowa has put together a special edition featuring thought-provoking and informative essays about Iowa history. Those essays are in conversation with the work of Iowa artists. Over the next couple of months, I'll be talking with some of the historians and artists whose work is featured in this edition. Multidisciplinary artist Akwi Inji will be here in just a few minutes. With me right now is Ashley Howard, assistant professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Iowa. She wrote an essay titled Race and Iowa History for this edition of Annals of Iowa. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And Of course, we were just talking about how Iowa history, when I was growing up, and for so many of our listeners, was taught from a very specific perspective. And it was taught in a celebratory, a laudatory way. But so much of Iowa history was left out of that conversation. I will tell you that when I learned about Iowa history back in 1985, I did not learn about any African-American Iowans. I did not learn about Native Iowans. So tell me, as you approached writing this essay, what was going through your mind?
Well, part of it, what goes through my mind is that as a state, you know, we're so proud of our history and what we've done, what we've accomplished and where we're going. But we're not being honest with ourselves when we only tell a limited part of that story, when we only tell the brightest and the most triumphant moments in our story. And oftentimes when we bring in people on the social margins, whether they be racial or religion or gender, we begin to have a more complete sense of what the state means and what it means to the different people who live here. So that's what I really want to parse out. What happens when we tell a more inclusive story about this state?
And I do feel like so many people have been doing good work in this area, especially in recent years. So I don't want to make it sound like nobody has been sharing these stories. They are out there, but you do have to seek them out. You have to be open to them and looking for them in so many ways. And when we talk about looking at just very specifically Black history in Iowa, we tend to celebrate some very progressive moments in our Black history, our integration of schools, for example. But it also, I don't know, in some ways it focuses on the fact that there have been few Black Iowans over history, which isn't a very fair representation, is it?
It's not. And I think part of what gets missed is, you know, I'm very influenced by the historian Vincent Harding, who wants us to challenge how we tell these stories. And it's not just enough to include Black voices and Black actors into the story of Iowa history. We really need to understand the state from their perspective, right? And tell this rich history through Black eyes. And so if we think about, you know, why is it that there are so few Black people who reside in Iowa, which, again, we know there are plenty, but is it, how do we understand the structures? Do we look at the sundown towns that, you know, forbade having Black people live there? Do we look at the economic opportunities for Black people? When we begin to expand and understand this state's history from the perspective of Black people, we have a different way of understanding how the state came to be. And so many of the histories that exist that do that important work of recovering, rewriting Black narratives into the larger Iowa story are doing so with the dominant narrative that has been told time and time again. And what I'm calling for in my article is to even begin to reflect about the history and how Black voices are written into these histories to be more comprehensive and more inclusive in how we understand the inner workings of this state.
There, of course, are very dark sides of our history when it comes to racial justice here in the state of Iowa. Focusing solely on those dark moments is also not what you're recommending, right?
That's correct. And there has certainly been discriminatory laws, you know, from the beginning of our time as a state, there have been exclusionary laws preventing or discouraging African Americans to move here. There has also been a very robust civil rights movement and rights movement, which means that there was discrimination and oppression that people were facing. There's a long and frankly rather hidden history about racial violence, anti-Black racial violence in the state that some scholars are doing some really cutting edge and brilliant work on that I'm excited to see published. But yes, we cannot have the story of Black Iowans only be a story of victimization and terror, even though that is certainly a part of their lives. We need to look again about Black Iowa from the perspective of Black Iowans. How are they building rich communities? What are the intra within the community relationships and practices, these moments of joy, of celebration. You know, there was a Black Women's Book Club in Des Moines. There was a robust sorority and fraternal institutions in Iowa City for Black students who are making their own mini kind of Harlem Renaissance of the Black arts movement in Iowa. So when we only talk about it in this Black-white binary of white people always acting against Black people and Black people having no agency and always being the recipients of terror, you miss the important ways in which they are building community, they are sustaining themselves, and they're finding these moments of strength and pleasure and joy in their day-to-day lives.
In the last really 10 to 15 years, we've learned a great deal more about the Underground Railroad in Iowa and efforts to help freedom seekers make it to safety back prior to the Civil War. The way we tell those narratives, though, that also can be problematic because we do tend to tell them from the perspective of the white heroes who were helping to do this work.
It's true. And this is one of the kind of challenges of looking at the Midwest as a region writ large. So often our regional identity is crafted in a way that we are the good guys and the South are the bad guys, without really unpacking the complicated ways in which race has actually acted in the region, right? That this was imagined to be a kind of Yemen's paradise, right, for white workers, white farmers, and having their freedoms without the yoke of the race problems of the South. So across the Midwest, you see people really actively trying to create restrictions for Black people coming here. And we see this crisis, even though they may not want to, they're not pro-slavery, but when we see this influx of Black people coming into the Midwest as early as the 1830s, you begin to see the backlash. And so it becomes this difficult kind of spin that they only want to highlight and to really magnify these moments of white redemption in the Midwest without actually looking at the ways in which they are actively trying to prevent African-Americans to coming to the state. And so the Underground Railroad can be this moment of patting ourselves on the back and say, look how well we've done, but don't look at the things that we're hiding just on the other side of it.
Well, and I mentioned earlier that we do like to celebrate these highlights, these progressive moments in our history. When we look at the court case that made it possible to desegregate schools in the state of Iowa, that was an incredible moment. The Clark family led that effort, and it's, you know, it makes a lot of us very proud to look at that moment and say that happened here and that happened here first. We also look at Buxton, Iowa, which, you know, was a unique community. It was a coal mining community where Black Iowans and white Iowans were treated equally in that community. So those are some really special things about Iowa history. And I think it's important to teach those things. Is there a problem with how we teach those things?
I don't think there's a problem with how we teach these at all, because I think local history is one of the, you know, excellent articles in the journal talks about local history is so important for the sake of local history. We can't always need to tie it to these broad national narratives of, you know, American grandeur and exceptionalism. When we talk about those local studies, those are important for understanding why communities are unique, and in particular in Iowa, how we have a story that often differs from this national narrative. But those stories of Buxton must be told in conversation with broader trends, and to understand that this is an anomaly and this was a constructed community, and that even within Buxton, you had Blacks and white people often self-segregating for their own reasons, you know, going to church or sitting with their people. All of these things also tell a more complex story of how race factors into Iowa, not just this narrative of redemption. And if there's a Buxton, then there's hope for us all. We also have to unpack the why. why was Buxton allowed to exist that way? It was because it was a company town, and the boss wanted to have this type of environment. But we can look, you know, just a few miles outside and see, again, really the restrictions in which many cities were operating and making sure that Black residents didn't live there.
Right. And I know that not very far away from Buxton was the seat of the KKK in Iowa, in Centerville, for example. You grew up in Nebraska, right?
I did. Don't let that get out too much on us.
No, we're okay with it. I'm okay with it. So you are a Black woman from the Midwest, and you have focused on African-American history. When you interact with people from the rest of the country, what do people say when you tell them that you grew up in Nebraska and that you work in Iowa?
Oh, I mean, it's complete disbelief. You know, I'm shocked how so few people think that Black people exist in the Midwest. And first of all, it's because the majority of Black people in this country live in the Midwest outside of the South. That's the first thing. And there has to be this kind of mental gymnastics that takes place to excise places like Detroit or Chicago or St. Louis, cities that are read as Black spaces, from the Midwest. So it's this funny dance that people do to somehow render these places as not being Midwest. And for me, what I find to be so interesting and so compelling about why I do Black Midwestern studies is that so many of the things that as a nation we hold dear and have adopted into our national culture were actually birthed in the Black Midwest. If we think about Motown, if we think about the poetry of Langston Hughes, if we think of the books of Toni Morrison, if we think about Prince, these are all products of the Black Midwestern experience that have become canonical texts and really one of the core ideas of what our American culture is, coming right out of this region that we all call home.
And somehow we forget that is the case. You wrote a beautiful line about this. You said, to interpret Black Iowans as anomalies leads to their double erasure, the invisibilizing of Black struggle in the state, coupled with the disbelief that Black people live here. Tell me more about what that means.
Well, so as you alluded to, this idea that there are Black people in the Midwest is just, you know, mind-blowing. It's just something that people really can't grasp. And so that's the first way of invisibilizing Black people, just the very denial that we exist in this region. And then the second invisibilizing is when we bring attention to the ways that our lives, both in the present and historically, differ from the experiences of many of our white regional counterparts, that our struggles are also erased, and they're not tied to a larger institutional or structural element of the region, but rather in kind of this bootstrapping identity is put on the backs of people of color in this region, that if you just tried hard enough, you could get ahead. There's no racism here. There's no race problem to be managed. And so if you can't get ahead, it's your own fault. So it's the erasure of people as a whole in the region and the erasure of the struggles that those people have, which leads to some of, you know, the protest movements throughout Black people's history in this region, and most recently, uprisings that we've seen in, you know, Des Moines and Waterloo in the 1960s and Ferguson in 2014. And Minneapolis in 2020. This is all stemming from this double erasure that Black Midwesterners face.
And we know that here in Iowa, about 45% of Black Iowans live in specific cities in Iowa, like Waterloo, Cedar Rapids, Des Moines. But that number, 45%, we tend to say, oh, all Black Iowans live in these communities. What are we missing here?
And, you know, this was one of the things when I was researching the article that kind of blew my mind. Because I assume that most Black people who lived in Iowa were living in kind of the major urban centers of the state, whereas in fact, 55% of them are living in small towns and communities. And for me, that was really generative, because what we often see is that when Black people in the Midwest are talked about, they're talked about in the urban context. And by just simply shifting our gaze to think about what the Black experience looks like in smaller communities, we actually have to rewrite how we think about Black history in itself. If you're not having large institutions like the NAACP or the Urban League to kind of create this groundswell of activism, if you don't have Black churches or, Black organizations like the Eastern Stars, how do Black people find community? How do they navigate their spaces? How do they see themselves? And I think this also creates a desire to do more complex analysis of the Black experience of Iowa. And so that is by bringing in issues about region, even within the region, and also things like class, about immigration status, about gender, about queer identities. And so really seeing the very broad and complex picture of what it means to be Black in Iowa beyond kind of the convenient tropes and narratives that we often fall back on.
Ashley, stay with us. Ashley Howard is Assistant Professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Iowa. She wrote an essay titled Race and Iowa History for the special edition of Annals of Iowa that's marking the 175th anniversary of Iowa statehood. We're going to bring artist Akwi Inji into the conversation here in just a moment. And you can join us as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call if you have something you'd like to share on this topic. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, conversations inspired by the 175th anniversary of Iowa statehood. That milestone is coming up in December, and to mark this occasion, the history journal Annals of Iowa has put together a special edition featuring essays about Iowa history that are in conversation with the work of Iowa artists. With me right now is Ashley Howard, Assistant Professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Iowa. She wrote an essay titled Race and Iowa History. And now joining us, one of the artists whose work is in conversation with these essays. Akwi Inji is a multidisciplinary artist who's working in Waterloo. Her work is featured in this collection and is called Uprising Does Not Always Roar Like a Fire. Akwi, hello.
Hello, Charity. It's so good to talk with you. And hello, Ashley.
Well, it's wonderful to have you back again. And I have a picture of your artwork in front of me, but I'm sure that the photo doesn't really do it justice. This is a mixed media collage that you've created with textiles and other materials. Can you describe it for me?
Sure. So it is about, in size, it's about 5.5 by 8.5, which is the standard size of a published memoir. And that was intentional. So it's roughly the size of a small book. And it is canvas wrapped in material that's teal in color. Linen is one of the materials, and then overlapping the linen is another layer of teal tulle, so sort of a net fabric, if you imagine sort of ballerina skirts, but all wrapped around fairly tightly and then layered. And then there's some vertical imagery with a string of wooden sculpted beads that are strung with some gold wire. And those beads are dark wood in color with some nice soft variations in the woods. So that gives you hopefully a sense, a visual sense of size and color.
And texture. And the description, it's so hard to do it justice because it also It almost looks like it's in movement. The tool that's teal almost looks like water to me. And along that linen edge, there are frayed strings coming off the edge. And so I can sense the movement there as well.
Yes, absolutely. And that was intentional. And I'm glad that it does evoke water imagery for you, because that was the intent. So
let's go back to when you were creating this collage. As I mentioned, the title is Uprising Does Not Always Roar Like Fire. And we can talk more about what that means in a moment. But you were creating this at such a difficult and pivotal moment in 2020.
I was. It was right around July, July, August 2020. So a couple of things were really front and center in my mind. The first was certainly the pandemic. We were still in the early, relatively, as you know, come to find out as time would unfold.
Right. We thought we were almost done, but we were not.
Exactly. Still in the relatively early months of the pandemic. And but also very, very much in the throes of the racial unrest and intense focus around the country and certainly in the state. And really at that time is when there were a lot of protests that were emerging throughout the entire state, and just recognizing that this was an opportunity as I was creating art to really evaluate what my role was as a Black woman in Iowa, in one of the cities that was experiencing a lot of protest, and also as a mother to two daughters, and as an artist and an educator. You know, my work in Waterloo is with the Waterloo School, so I've appreciated the conversation so far around history, art, and education and the intersection between those three things. And so what is my role as an artist and as an educator, both within my own home and within my community? And so all of that was at work in the work, and both in the heart work and the head work, and then ultimately in the physical labor of creating this particular piece, Uprising Does Not Always Roar Like Fire.
And during the summer of 2020, we were all, at least those of us with the privilege to be, we were basically homebound in many ways. Mm-hmm. And so you were there with your daughters, and it was one of your daughters that really helped you conceive of this project, right?
Well, she didn't necessarily help me conceive of it, but it was sort of co-creation.
Okay.
In some ways. And so I was very, very intentional about where I was creating my work during that summer. I posted myself in the center of our house. Our island was my primary workspace, and that was intentional because I wanted the girls, as they were moving around the house, to be very physically engaged with my creative process. And I really believe in what is possible in sort of casual, informal conversation and opportunities that arise in those kinds of situations. And so my 14-year-old, she's also an artist. And so she would walk past it and I'd say, "Hey, Amaya, what do you think I'm doing here? What do you see?" Or I'd ask for her advice in some cases. You know, I'd get stuck in assembling it in a certain spot or particular choice that I was trying to make didn't feel quite right. And so I'd invite her input. And again, for me, this was both learning for her and an opportunity to engage in deeper conversation. And so when she'd stop by and she'd look at it and she'd say, "Well, Mom, what I see is," and she started talking about Harriet Tubman, and then she'd say, "Did you know that?" And it just made me smile inside, because my intent, it was working. My goal was working to create opportunity, very organic opportunity, although somewhat orchestrated and architected, to engage in deeper conversations about those things that were front and center for us as a family, and for the state and for the country, as it relates to race, identity, responsibility to ourselves and to our community. There were so many themes that emerged in conversations that were really catalyzed by the work that I was creating at the time.
Well, that's so beautiful, Akwi, because it sounds like an incredible achievement as an artist and as a mother, too. So that's incredible. And that's sort of what's encapsulated in this work. There's so much power and so much work that is done that we do not see. It's not as visible as the kinds of protests or other uprisings that we've seen over the centuries.
Yes, and that was, for me, part of what I was intellectualizing, too, is, you know, I didn't feel the level of comfort that others did in terms of going out and participating in in-person protests and marches and that type of thing. And so I was really working to think through, you know, over time and throughout history, what does that mean in terms of gender? What is the role that mothers, that sisters, that daughters, that wives have played to the historical figures, generally male, whose names are known? And so one of those things for me was just an opportunity, again, you know, recognizing that even with my daughter, who understood intuitively what I was trying to do with the work visually, the fact that she evoked Harriet Tubman's name into the conversation was important for me. Felt like my goal was really truly being realized. And then recognizing that protest and transformation, protests that hopefully positive protests that leads to transformation, that's one way that we engage in positive transformation at a community level. It is one way, and there is magnificent and important and powerful work happening behind the scenes, in boardrooms, in offices, but also within our homes. And I would also say, I want to just be transparent. I was rereading Ashley's essay this morning and shouldn't maybe have I'm thankful that I had enough time in between reading it and actually being on the air with you, because it gave me a chance to collect myself. But rereading her essay just brought me to tears a little bit for a variety of reasons. And one of those reasons was when she says episodes of anti-Black terror must be documented, but so too must Black joy and everyday Black life. I wanted the energy of my home and my role as a mother to daughters and my passion for joy and my passion for creativity. I wanted all of that to be also woven into the art. And so the art, while it is an examination of and a reflection on history, it's also within it some really dynamic energy of what was happening in my home and who I am as a human being, and who I am as a human being when it comes to being Black and Iowan. You know, I appreciate the sort of dual erasure that has been addressed. And I would add that there's sort of a triple erasure in my life, because I'm Cameroonian as well. And so there's a layer of that I grapple with too in the work.
Well, and the reason that I have you both here together, Akwi and Ashley, is because, you know, your work is in conversation in the annals of Iowa. Although, Akwi, you weren't looking at Ashley's work and Ashley wasn't looking at your work when you each created what you created for this special edition. But it's wonderful to hear both your voices and your stories here. And Ashley, I would just love for you to respond a little bit to what Akwi is saying and thinking about that conversation.
Well, I first of all, it's a delight to be with you here, Akwi, and I was so moved by your piece because it's so beautiful and it has such life in it, and it really harkens back to some of the earliest art traditions of Black people in this country, of textile art, right? And so quilting and the use of dress as a way to explore our identities and to carve out that little space for ourselves. So I think it's so very beautiful. And the other thing that moved me by this piece is the use of the natural elements, right? That we are part of this place. We are not just visitors. We are not passersby. We are not folks en route from one place to another. We are Iowans. We are part of this community. We built it literally with our hands, and our blood, sweat, and tears are in the soil. And so it's just such a beautiful, beautiful representation of everything that we have been experiencing the past 2 years. And I'm of the opinion that scholars, historians, and artists need to do more and to speak more, because our work can talk about the same topics, but touch people in different and profound ways. And so it's been a joy to have this pairing.
Let's talk with the time that we have left. We only have a few minutes, but part of this project, and I know each of your work, is that as we look back, we can learn about our past, we can learn more about who we are, but this is also about who we are moving forward. And Ashley, I'll let you go first. What do you feel like you want people to take away from reading your essay and thinking about moving forward?
Well, thank you so much for this question, because, you know, there's so much to talk about. And one thing that I really wanted to make sure that I address before this interview concludes is I am a specialist in African-American history. That is my expertise. So that is what I have focused on. But so much work needs to be done across the broad range of identities. So we need more Latinx history, we need more Asian history, we need more Indigenous history, all of kind of the identities that people have as Iowans, including queer, including class, including I don't know, everything, age, all of the ways that people find themselves representative. And the final thing is, I think, and I'm so glad, Akwa, you mentioned this, right, that the new Black Iowa is not the same as the migrations that came here in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And it's the same with Latinx and many of the Asian American Iowans who are coming here. These are global people. They are recent immigrants, or they are the descendants of recent immigrants. And so what they are adding to our community looks very different and needs to be addressed in a way that we cannot think of when we talk about the 1950s or the 1960s. And so, again, to really continue to challenge how we see Iowa history and how we see the people who make up our society, not to just to fall into bad habits of just including people and moving on, but really to see the state and this history through the people who are living it, through their experiences and through their eyes.
And of course, we are all living history every day. Akwi, we only have about a minute and a half left, but what do you want to add to that in thinking about moving forward?
Yeah, I think it's just important to honor those narratives as dynamic narratives, as dynamic identities, exactly as Ashley has said, and that those narratives are told in a variety of different ways. And one of those ways that we try to do it is certainly through our artwork. And just thankful for those opportunities when the artwork is able to engage in conversation around themes that are so important to the civic landscape.
We are going to spend some time exploring some of the other essays that were published in this special edition of Annals of Iowa over the next couple of months. There are so many different elements to Iowa history. And Ashley, I'll give you the final word here. Often when we study Iowa history, we do reinforce this mythology of Iowa that tends to romanticize the settlers who came here and this idea of a most white state of agrarian people. This is an exciting moment in time, as fraught as it is. I mean, do you feel excitement of the opportunities of this moment that at least we're talking about history in a new way?
100%. There's a scholar by the name of Gary Okiharo who talks about margins and mainstream. And his argument is that those on the margins have done more to advance American ideals than those in the mainstream. So the more we understand those hidden histories of people who may have not been able to participate fully in the polity, the more we understand their histories and their struggles, the more inclusive, exceptional, and inclusive our great country will be.
Ashley Howard, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley Howard, Assistant Professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Iowa. She wrote an essay titled Race and Iowa History for Annals of Iowa. Akwi Inji, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Charity. It's been great to talk with you and Ashley.
Akwe Inji is a multidisciplinary artist based in Cedar Rapids. Her work in this collection is Uprising Does Not Always Roar Like Fire. This is Talk of Iowa.